Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
It's the Autosport Podcast. We look back at the Formula One career of Niki Lauda and pick out his greatest races. Formula One world is still reeling from the loss of the great Niki Lauda, a three times world champion and an ever present in the paddock in recent years, and his role with Mercedes and his German television work. So a very, very familiar part of the Formula One world all the way up to his unfortunate death. Now, Niki Lauda is an interesting driver. He's a driver whose whole perception is dominated by that life-threatening crash he had at the Nürburgring in 1976. And really, this we wanted to look into his career, do what we do with some of the great drivers, and really delve into him as a driver, as a racer, what he did, and try and kind of work out where in the pantheon of the greats exactly Niki Lauda stands. I'm your host, Ed Straw, and joining me for this endeavour, as usual, is Kevin Turner. Of course, now you did have a Niki Lauda great races. Obviously, the great races are always a key part of these driver podcasts we do. You sort of had a Lauda on the back burner, but you've had to dedicate quite a bit of time over last weekend, I think, to getting it all done.
Yes, yeah, I have probably about 15 to 20 of these lists on the go at any one time as I'm reading different things. I had another race here or there. But yeah, Niki caught us a bit by surprise, I think. I think we all just thought he was indestructible, didn't we? Even though obviously we knew there were problems with his lung transplant. So yes, I didn't really have much sorted when we got the news last week. So the last few days in between Monaco Grand Prix, Indy 500 and all the rest of it, desperately reading lots of Niki Lauda's autobiography and various reports and videos and things to put the list together.
Well, let's start out, Kev. Where do you think Niki Lauda, just as a driver, is placed? Because he's rarely in the conversation for the absolute great. I'm talking the top half dozen or so. He doesn't often break into that discussion. I mean, he's clearly up there, but what do you think the sort of perception is of Lauda as a driver?
Oh, well, funny enough, I was part of my preparation for these is essentially to have an argument with myself, which is quite amusing, I think, if anyone to watch. But I was wondering where would I slot him in. I think he's on the bubble for the top 10, I think. I mean, that good. You know, I think I had him, I kept moving around sort of between 10 and 12. So, I mean, that's top draw, isn't it? I don't think you'd quite have him up there with, you know, he doesn't define his era in quite the same way.
It's the old bar racing thing, isn't it? You know, he was a great driver. And there were areas where he did raise the bar, I guess, but it wasn't kind of a big stride forward in terms of what a Grand Prix driver is.
No, that's probably fair. And also, I think where you can say somebody like Jackie Stewart before him was, I think, you wouldn't debate that he wasn't he was the best driver of his era. I think Ronnie Peterson fans or even Mario Andretti fans or Gilles Villeneuve fans would perhaps suggest that Lauda wasn't the de facto best driver of his era. I mean, statistically he was, and actually, of course, as we'll get to in a minute, he was not a million miles away from being a four-time world champion in the 70s. So that would have really much stamped his authority on that period. So I think he's in the top 10 to dozen, I think, is probably where you'd place him.
Which, when we put in the fact that there's 33 world champions in history, that still puts him kind of in the top third or so, give or take, of those. So, you know, that's not to do him down.
Oh, absolutely.
A really great driver. Well, of course, any discussion of Lauda is framed in the context of that accident that did almost kill him, the Nürburgring in 1976 in the German Grand Prix, and his sensational comeback, the whole battle for the championship with James Hunt and retiring from the Japanese Grand Prix because he felt the conditions were not good enough, which is probably a fair decision. But there was a lot more to Lauda than that, isn't there? You know, we had the driver before the accident who was considered a bit of a no-hoper in his early years, wasn't he? He wasn't the driver that people were getting excited about when he was he started off racing in a Mini Cooper, did some sports cars, did some single-seater racing, but without massively making an impact.
No, although it's interesting because, like a lot of these great drivers, he did have some experience of, as a kid, jumping into, I think it was Volkswagen Beetle he had at one stage that he was tearing around his, you know, the family grounds or wherever it was. I think it was granddad's place. So again, he was one of these people that had experience of driving a vehicle long before he was able to get a license. So by the time he, you know, was old enough, he already had what you would call natural ability, but actually, of course, it's learned through that early practice, really. But there's an interesting part of Ronnie Peterson's autobiography, because obviously Lauda early on bought himself effectively a seat at March and was Ronnie's teammate in Formula 2. And Ronnie was quite sure that Lauda was pretty good. Everyone else would say, oh, he's just a pay driver, just a pay driver. I said, no, he's really good. And there's a race at one part where I think Nicky basically finished on Ronnie's gearbox. And if you think at the time, Peterson was regarded as the upcoming guy, the king of F2, you know, second in his first full championship season in Formula 1. So I think that the people that really paid attention could tell that there was something there. That because of the way the team was structured, it didn't work. So I think Ronnie did the first test with the new car and said, yeah, it's fabulous. And Nicky got into it. And as he was later to it, Ferrari got out and went, well, that's pretty hopeless. But he was just the pay driver. Ronnie, had, you know, was the star driver, got out and said, oh, it's fabulous and it's fine. And I think the team basically didn't listen to him. Obviously, they didn't know at that point probably how good Nicky was and how strong his technical feedback was. So if they'd let Lauda develop the car, and then at that point, Ronnie would have been, you know, the quicker guy. But I suspect as the car got better, Nicky would have got closer to Ronnie's pace anyway. You know, Ronnie was renowned for driving around problems. You know, he was probably one of the worst test drivers than he looked, and I think he got frustrated. But just to go back to the debt thing, that's another example of a very get into Formula 1, then I'm going to be paying this off for 10, 20, 30 years. If I can make it in Formula 1, I might be earning enough to earn it to pay it off in 3 or 4. So it became I have to be an F1 driver. And it's just a very rational, sort of dispassionate approach to it, which is quite interesting.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. It's either the rational, logical approach or it's the gambler's fallacy, isn't it?
Yes, that's true.
But I think the thing that I like is this reputation, rightly, as being very single-minded, focused, determined, and that must have been there then, because you can take that position of, well, I've got to kind of double down on this and try and make the money back, but a lot would have kind of cut their losses and not thrown good money after bad. So even in those days when, you know, his results, they weren't terrible, they weren't astonishing, so to have that within him, that ability just to keep raising the stakes, I think was a characteristic that played a big part in him becoming as successful as he did.
Absolutely. And you can see it from his early life as well. He's, you know, falling out with his, you know, his family, who think he should do something, you know, more right and proper, that, you know, classic old debate. And he just, yeah, he sort of plowed his own furrow from the start, really. And I think that he actually did maintain throughout his life.
And we did see with BRM, he moved there in 1973. Now, BRM was a team in decline at that point, but it was still kind of a handy rent-a-drive kind of team. They ran quite a few cars at times in 73, but we did start to see how good he was. If you look at it over the season, his pace compared to Clay Regazzoni, who was a well-established driver, was pretty good. And that obviously gave him a platform to get this unexpected move to Ferrari.
Yes, and there are little hints again, if you look for them, as his strengths that were there. So he did make some progress with making the CAD for most of the season. But he identified that the V12 was a bit hopeless compared to the Cosworth DSO. So he spoke to Lewis Stanley, the team boss. And Stanley was, I think by that time, he liked playing at being the F1 team boss. Goes away for a few minutes, come back on the phone. We found 20 brake horsepower more in the exhaust system. And Nicky just went, this is just ridiculous. As obviously you haven't. So he was at that time he was pushing to improve things before you even got to the racetrack. It's just that for different reasons at March and then BRM, he didn't get what he needed.
But there was enough at BRM. There was the qualified six and ran third at Monaco. He also led a chunk of the Canadian Grand Prix at Mossport Park. So we did start to see these signs. Actually, he was a serious driver. But even then, I think it did come as a surprise to people that Ferrari went for him. Obviously, they bought Regazzoni back in for 74, and there's talk that Regazzoni recommended Lauda as well, but also that it's sort of lost in the mist of time exactly what the mechanism was, whether it was watching that Monaco performance that clearly played a part. Regazzoni's recommendation clearly played a part as well.
Yeah, it's quite a thinking of Ferrari's driver choices over the years, it is quite an unusual choice. But probably one of the best driver decisions Ferrari ever made, I would think.
Absolutely inspired, really. And it was also a Ferrari that at that time was not quite in the shape it should have been. They were struggling. I don't think they won a race in 73, did they? So it was a time where they needed a kind of refresh and a different approach. And obviously Lauda ultimately, he quite quickly established himself as the lead driver in that team. And then, you know, they were away with just having this great success in the middle of the 70s.
I think there are strong parallels with the Michael Schumacher era in that respect, in the, you know, the right people coming together at the right time. The difference being, of course, that it wasn't a huge punt to take Michael Schumacher in 1996 because he was already obviously the best driver in the world and double world champion. Whereas, yeah, as we say, Lauda didn't really have many results to his name. But I think that, you know, the outcome turned out to be quite similar.
Well, the amazing thing was that although it was Regazzoni that had the run of the championship in that year, he was still in contention in the last race in 74, wasn't he? But didn't manage to win it. Lauda was leading the championship after the British Grand Prix, and then he had a run of retirements, not all of them entirely outside of his control, shall we say. But he could have been champion in that year as well. It just maybe took him a little bit of time to sort of dial himself. And he was still a driver with rough edges at that stage, though, wasn't he? He wasn't the calculating race-winning machine that he was soon to become.
No, there was actually the British Grand Prix that year is quite an interesting one. Lots of things happened in that race. I mean, he should have won it for a start. And he got a slow puncture. And I think it was Pete Lyons wrote the Autosport report for that. And he suggested that perhaps Lauda would have been better off coming and getting it changed and perhaps getting a third or a fourth. Whereas he tried to, I don't think this is a kind of Villeneuve 79 Dutch Grand Prix situation, though. I think it was a slow puncher and it was quite near the end. So he thought, maybe I can get away with it. And it didn't work. And he came into the pits. And then, of course, he had the farcical situation of not being able to get out of the pit lane at the end because there was a course car in the way. And then there was wrangling about that afterwards. So that whole race really summed up his 74 season, I think, of incredibly quick. But just one way or another, things didn't quite go his way, as we see sometimes.
But he had effectively established himself as the lead driver really going into 75, despite Regazzoni's previous success. I think it was abundantly clear within the team, and probably clear to Lauda at this point, that he was the guy.
Yeah, I don't think at any point when they're at BRM or at Ferrari that Lauda was particularly concerned about beating Regazzoni. I mean, they got on pretty well, I think, but I think he knew that he had the beating of him.
Then this, of course, laid the platform for that 75 championship, which I think is the point where you do start to see the kind of relentless Lauda, very few mistakes being made. I think he rounded off a lot of those edges. He was still a very quick driver, and it's often forgotten that he was quite an aggressive driver in that era, and he did have his fair share of incidents, maybe more than his fair share of incidents. Perhaps this is in the spell before the Nürburgring shunt. But I think we have a tendency to kind of look at a driver as a steady state throughout their career, don't we? But Lauda really did make big improvements in, say, the first 3-4 years he was in Formula One.
Well, I think he was quite honest with himself. I always think that's a sign of somebody who's going to be successful if they're honest with themselves. They don't necessarily have to tell the wider world what all their faults are, but as long as they're honest about what they are and go away and improve them. And also, of course, remember that the 312T of 1975, I think, was a step on. The 74 car was good and obviously competitive, but I think the 312T was the start of a new sort of competitive era. I think he probably wasn't having to work so hard. He could get the car where he wanted it. And of course, when you get somebody who's like that, who's on top of the game, they've sort of got the race half won before they've even started. And I think there were a few races there where, you know, Lauda had all the boxes ticked and was able to reel off the wins. Like the really great, you've said before, Ed, the really great drivers kind of make it look easy when they're on top form. And I think he was getting to that point, or he'd got to that point for 75.
Yeah, very much so. And the 75 Lauda Ferrari combination was just crushingly dominant. There wasn't really a battle for the championship, and there was a mid-season stretch of victories, of course, that put him in an impregnable position effectively. And it must have been amazing to see this guy kind of go from this pay driver no hoper, as he was unfairly seen by some, but he was bringing money. He wasn't getting results in the March, certainly in F1, because it wasn't really possible to. If you think about it, that sort of thing, it's rare that happens. Yeah, we have seen great drivers come in off the back of funding and that kind of thing in the past, but for it to have this sort of slow burn and then suddenly, oh, actually, no, he's really, really good.
Yeah, the greatest pay driver in history.
Yeah, because even, for example, you could say someone like Fernando Alonso, not pay driver such, but he came obviously with Minardi. So on paper, his 2001 season with Minardi wasn't much good, but it actually was very good. And there were people who were spotting how strongly he was doing. This wasn't what Lauda was doing. So to make that transition, just remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, but as you say, learnt quickly as well because of that honesty. And I think, we'll get onto the accident in a minute, but I don't think in terms of his ability, it changed. I think maybe the way he went about his business was changed. But I think generally he was, and obviously he had to go through an awful lot emotionally. But I think he was, you know, he was still a great driver after the accident as he was before.
Lauda's not a driver who's often talked about just for his sheer pace and his speed. We don't often hear him talked about like that, which I think is a little bit unfair, actually, because he was clearly extremely quick.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a legacy of the last couple of years at McLaren, when, yeah, he was, well, obviously he was up against one of those top 10 drivers you're talking about before with Alain Prost, and Prost was at that stage in what you'd call the Senna era of his life, before Senna came along and Prost was in the Lauda role of being the quick guy. And Lauda's very honest in his autobiography about just not wanting to hang on to 1,000 brake horsepower, didn't know what he had underneath him. Yeah, he wanted to know lap by lap, and yeah, he knew race pace, he was there, but he didn't really, I think he thought it was all a bit crazy, qualifying with turbo engines cranked up. And also, he not that important. Once he'd proved that he could come through the field, which he did many, many times, you know, he's got to be one of those great drivers to win from furthest back more often than most people. I think he probably thought it was an unnecessary risk to try and find another half second or second if it was going to be immaterial and he was going to be driving a completely different type of car come the race anyway. So he sort of, again, logical decision, I don't really need to hang it out. What's the point?
And we should also bear in mind, I mean, rolling forward a little bit, for example, when he retired shortly before the end of the 79 season, retired the first time, I mean, from Brabham, obviously it was a terrible season for Brabham, but it's, you know, it's sometimes sort of characterised that he didn't quite have the determination to go up, say, against a young Nelson Piquet, but he was about as quick as Piquet over the season. He wasn't being outperformed by this young Charger. So even though his interest was waning, by his own admission, that's what led to him getting out of the car in Canada and saying, no, not doing this anymore. But he was still very quick.
Yeah, he doesn't once mention Piquet in that respect. I mean, actually, he's very complimentary about Piquet. He's one of the sort of top four drivers he picks out that he came up against. But he's very clear about, yeah, he's sort of, well, what's the point in this? And he went out, he said he went out for a session because he retired from the meeting where they had the Brabham Cosworth. And he said that it wasn't a 12. It felt a bit boring and can I really be bored? And he just decided there and then to give up, which he later is why he didn't do that in 85. He felt that that was perhaps the wrong way of doing it. But at the time, he went, I don't want to do this anymore. Came in, told Bernie and Bernie Eccleston, team boss, and Bernie actually helped him escape the track before anyone else realised what was going on.
Did they send Ricardo Zanino out in his helmet?
They did, in his helmet, yeah, which Lauda's quite funny about in his autobiography, Tell Him Back, which I do recommend. But yes, he said it must have been confusing for the other drivers. Why doesn't Nicky know what he's doing? He's all over the place.
So suddenly believe he's got a little bit slower. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? But the... I guess we have to sort of address the question of the accident. And the 76 season, there's so much written and talked and endlessly about the 76 season. The first thing we should say is, without that Nürburgring accident, he's got that championship wrapped up with races to spare, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's at a canter, I think, really. I mean, he's dominant. I think that James Hunt did drive an amazing season, and I think for the story it's great that he won it at the end and all the rest of it, but in a normal course of events then Lauda would have, yeah, that would have been one of those dominant seasons, and he'd have had it wrapped up with, as you say, with a few rounds to go. Fuji would have been irrelevant.
It's amazing to think, isn't it, he conceivably could have won the 74 title. You could argue he maybe wasn't quite ready there, but could have won 74, did win 75, should have won 76 and still almost did despite it. You know, 177, and if 76 Nürburgring hadn't happened, maybe he's still at Ferrari. We'll probably talk about that shortly. But before we get onto that, let's hear from Giorgio Piola, of course, the legendary technical illustrator, knew Lauda well in that era. Used to speak to him regularly. Obviously, Giorgio Piola has been around Formula One since 1969, so he just beat Lauda to it. I spoke to him for one of our videos. If you check out our YouTube channel, it's got all sorts of videos analysing Formula One, and you can also find those on our website at motorsport.tv. So Giorgio's got some interesting insight actually into the kind of the change of Nicky Lauda from that accident. I think people will be very interested to hear what he has to say as someone who knew him in that period.
Nicky had two life for me. The one before the accident, it was quite very difficult to be a journalist and talking with him because he was very technical, nearly a driver computer, much more than Schumacher, for example. So he was talking not so much, he was very shy, and he was talking only about the cars, and let's say nearly no giving any conception to the human side. After the accident, I found a completely different man. I had to understand slowly, because at the beginning, the difference was so big, but you had to understand that he wanted to live again. So he made his birth by himself, not because of his mother. After the terrible accident in Nürburgring, everybody would have stopped with Formula One. He wanted, and nearly less than 2 months, he came in Monza. It was a big shock because every time he was taking out his balaclava, there was the blood coming out, so he was suffering a lot. He really built his life, and he built like a man, a real man, very, very deep, very human. He completely, I tell you, two different person. And it's good because the second person was even better than the other one. The other one was only a wonderful driver. The second person was still a wonderful driver and a wonderful man.
And of course, it is life-defining, that accident he had at Nürburgring in 1976. But the amazing thing about Nicky Lauda, Giorgio, is that determination he had. Because to him, it seemed that he had to come back that quickly. He almost won the World Championship. And of course, he pulled out of the Japanese Grand Prix at the end of the season in terrible rain because of the conditions, and he still might have beaten James Hunt to the championship. So this, we keep hearing people pay tribute to him, telling about this determined character, this sort of straight talking, no nonsense. He just, it's fascinating to hear you say that almost that character was what he became after the accident.
And you have to understand also that it was a very straightforward man. For example, Mauro Fargieri, the chief engineer of Ferrari, when it happened in Fuji, he wanted to find an excuse, a mechanical failure to the car, and he said, no way, I can't drive it. So he was totally honest, even sometimes quite brutal, aggressive. And he loved always to say what he's thinking. And it was very funny because after the accident, and then he was staying with Ferrari, we were talking in Italian, and his Italian was really very funny because, of course, you learn from the mechanical. So a lot of, if you say rude words, but when he was saying something, even three lines, you could make a wonderful feature because he was always point to the most important fact. He was very sincere, very tough, very honest with everybody and with him himself.
Well, of course, this honesty from Niki Lauda you talked about, he never really was a politician, was he? Which is strange, really, because he did work in those sorts of circles. But, you know, if something went wrong, if there was something that the team hadn't done correctly, obviously there was a famous disqualification.
Yeah, it happened in Belgium. And, of course, I went there to make the interview. And, you know, usually the driver, when they are disqualified, they start to complain like a little child, say, it's not right, I drove, I risked my life, I won the race, it's not fair to disqualify him. And the car, his car, his McLaren, was underweight. And in a very typical Italian, with some rude word, he said, my team was really very bad, but he used a tougher word. And myself, I played the fool because I drove an illegal car. No excuse, just black and white.
And of course, this was something that continued to be Niki Lauda's trademark even after Formula One, because of course he was a regular in the Formula One paddock. He later was an advisor to Ferrari for many years, his RTL television work in Germany, and then in 2010, when the Mercedes Formula One team, actually just behind us we've got the Mercedes motorhome, he became the non-executive chairman of that team and played a key role in creating this team. And it seems appropriate that when Niki passed away, his team had just taken five consecutive 1-2 finishes, a show of supreme dominance greater than anything they'd even done before.
And it's a pity that he had to stop his career, because I'm sure he could have won other world championship title. And as you said, even in his role with Mercedes, was really always very loyal, very pushing, very close to the driver, very close, for example, to Hamilton also, and the relationship with the driver were very good. Maybe sometime he forgot that Niki Lauda and Clay Regazzoni, they make nearly three or four accidents with Ferrari, making collision with themselves, because at that time was the first Niki. He was much more aggressive. But anyway, talking again about Mercedes and Ferrari, I remember the last time that I talked with him, he said something that now I can say because there will be no problem anymore. But he said, for my work, for my profession, I'm a Mercedes. But whenever I win, my heart is still beating very hard, because the passion, it was really with the Ferrari.
Of course, two world championships for Ferrari, so he's synonymous with the team. But you mentioned the relationship with the drivers, and of course, Lauda was instrumental in convincing Lewis Hamilton to jump ship from McLaren and join Mercedes ahead of 2013. It was the 2012 Singapore Grand Prix weekend, a combination of a long conversation with Lauda and another McLaren reliability problem. He had a gearbox failure while leading, perhaps convinced him to commit. And it's just, you know, the relationship he was able to have with the drivers, the understanding. They knew he knew what they were doing, and he understood them. And that's a rare thing, to have somebody who understands drivers, who understands teams, who understands the corporate world as well. And all these aspects, you know, if one of these parts of Niki Lauda was his legacy, you'd think an amazing individual. But to combine all this as an airline, three airline companies, see, just a remarkable individual.
Yes, as I tell you, he made two lives. And the second life for me was unbelievably like a miracle. In every aspect you can see, all what you said is fantastic, is true. His relationship with the driver were fantastic, because the driver were trusting him. It was a man that he was saying even one word, but you were trusting him. And there are very few people that you trust so much in Formula One, because a lot of people, especially in Formula One, they are very politician. Even the driver now, they are not so straightforward, black and white like he was, and some other driver, another one, for example, Jackie Stewart. He was always fantastic, always saying what he's thinking. Niki is this. Everything he was saying, we were trusting completely, no doubt.
And as a technical driver, people always talk about his intelligence, his understanding. Obviously, this is your specialist area. And even when you were speaking to him regularly, when he was behind the wheel of the Ferrari, do you think he was one of these drivers, like a Prost, who really did have that deeper level of understanding?
Sure. Maybe from the technical point of view, even deeper than the Prost. And it's funny, because if you look in internet, there are some funny quarreling between him and Mauro Forghieri, because Mauro Forghieri, even if he's a genius and engineer, in some way was a little bit more romantic in the attitude with the technical stuff. And sometimes he was saying something that Niki didn't trust. And there was a beautiful arguing. And Niki was always very focusing on the technical aspect to improve the car. For example, in BRM, they made a big improvement following his advice. and also in Ferrari, was also very good as a test driver in understanding and talking with the engineer, also with the engineer from the tire. So it was really very good, a very 100% driver and 120% as a man.
Great insight there from Giorgio Pio. And of course, this accident does dominate all thinking about Lauda, because it is what leads to him leaving Ferrari. You know, we speculate about how much success he could have had with Ferrari. Could he have been a 3, 4, 5, 6 times world champion with Ferrari? He could certainly still have been there in 79 when they won the title with Jody Scheckter, for example. But the whole fallout from that accident, the fact that he didn't get the backing from the team he felt should have been there, bringing Carlos Reutemann in, the fact that they then sort of tried to make Reutemann the lead, the number one driver and the guy who was steering it, and basically Niki Lauda deciding, right, well, okay, I'm going to win the championship again and I'm going to go away. And in retrospect, I think Lauda has said perhaps that was a mistake and it was maybe driven a little bit by emotion, which you can't blame him for. With what he's been through, he's come back. You know, the descriptions of what he did at Monza, which was about 5, 6 weeks after the accident, wasn't it? To go there, finish fourth. And there's a piece by Nigel Roebuck in the latest Autosport magazine where he talks about seeing Niki get out of the car. I think it was after the race, wasn't he? And it's just trying to peel the balaclava off, and then he just realises this isn't working, just tears it off. Just the pain of that, a simple task, just shows how difficult that whole thing must have been. So you can understand why he was a little bit put out. Then they decided that he wouldn't be capable of it. You can't necessarily blame Ferrari for being a little bit thinking, well, are you still going to be? Like, bringing in Reutemann wasn't necessarily in itself a bad thing, but the fact they brought in Reutemann and then suddenly seemed to switch to him and decided that Niki wasn't up to it, even though he'd come back and proved he was pretty unfair on him, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think he felt there were mixed messaging within Ferrari. I think publicly they sort of did quite a sort of supportive job, but within the team, I think there were probably some people who were behind him and some people that felt, oh, well, no, he's yesterday's guy, he's finished, let's move on to the next thing. And
it's kind of the old Ferrari thing, isn't it? Like, you drive it, but the driver kind of has the fatal accident, but he's still there, still racing. They don't quite know how to deal with it.
No,
move on to the next one.
Well, he said that Enzo, because I think he had a reasonable relationship with Enzo Ferrari. I mean, he actually says, yeah, if there was an issue with something, he would just go and see Enzo. And other people thought that was ridiculous. You can't do that. But he said Enzo was always absolutely fine. Knocked on the door, went in, spoke to him about something, and he, again, logical. Well, I'm going to go and speak to the guy that can make this better. So I think there was some respect there, but he talked about an offer that Enzo made, I think, at the end of 76, about being team boss for 77.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And he thought, what's this about? And then he said, then I twigged. Obviously, but he doesn't really know what to do with me. He's not convinced that I'm going to be back to what I was, but he doesn't want me driving for anyone else, just in case I am. I am still on top form.
This is where Lauda started to do these threats about, oh, well, McLaren will have me.
That's right,
which I think was totally fabricated. But I guess if you're looking at that, you're thinking, well, they're not going to replace James Hunt, but they might replace Jochen Mass.
Yeah, imagine a Hunt-Lauda team at McLaren for 77.
That would have made a good film, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But actually, mentioning the film leads me just to think about something else about Lauda, which the view of him... which is reasonable, is this very calculating character, very focused, very determined. I do think that the film Rush, the Ron Howard film, which is a very good film, it almost creates that false polar opposites between Hunt and Lauda, because Lauda wasn't an unfeeling, calculating machine, while Hunt was the good time guy who was just the complete opposite. That they were actually, well, they got on very well. They're actually quite similar, and Lauda was perhaps a more emotional character than is made out.
Oh, definitely was, yeah. He talks about how much emotion he was going through, obviously during the accident, but throughout his career, but it was all about how to deal with it. Yeah, you logically had to rein myself in to deliver what I needed to deliver. A little bit like Jackie Stewart, actually. That's the take the emotion out of the cockpit. And I think he was still feeling those emotions. He was just doing a better job, if you like, of keeping them in check, keeping them in one part of his life, so that he could do what he did.
And of course, that decision to leave Ferrari did not work for him ultimately. He went to Brabham for 2 years. He won 2 races in 78, both have asterisks against them. One of them was in the fan car, the one-off fan car that was effectively but not literally banned after the 78 Swedish Grand Prix. And the other one was Monza, where, of course, he didn't win on the road, but there were jump start penalties. So it was a win, but not on the road. So that was just not the right time to be at Brabham, was it?
Not competitively, but I think he probably quite liked the change. He quite liked working with Bernie, because although he said Bernie was incredibly hard to negotiate with, once you'd got the deal and shaking your hand, that was it. Like, he would stick to his word. And I think that Nicky, again, straightforward, being honest thing, right, well, let's be absolutely at each other during negotiation. But once we've established what we're doing it. And he liked Gordon Murray as a designer. So I think he enjoyed his time at Brabham. The thing that let them down was, of course, the Alfa Romeo engine. Had it been a Brabham Cosworth at that point, I think an Eccleston, Lauda, Murray combination, that could have been quite different that era. So, yes, in terms of the raw numbers, it would have probably been better to stay at Ferrari. But maybe at that point in his life, it was the right thing for him. And let's not forget, he actually walked out on Ferrari before the end of 77. I've won the championship, goodbye. So he sort of had the last laugh, perhaps not quite the right phrase, but he told Enzo where to go. But he said, you know, years later they kind of healed that rift, and it was all, you know, I think Enzo did respond to that kind of thing, sort of respected, you know, being your own man.
And of course, Lauda did go on to have a long association,
of course,
as advisor to Ferrari in later years. So clearly, it wasn't too much of a riff. But yeah, well, when the Brabham finished, certainly in 78, it would finish quite well, but it didn't finish that often. And then 79, things were pretty bad. It wasn't especially competitive, and it certainly wasn't any more reliable. If anything, it was slower and less reliable than the year before. So I guess that's the interesting question, because he did talk about when he left Ferrari and moved to Brabham that he kind of felt the weight off his shoulders. So it's quite easy to say, well, if he stayed at Ferrari, he'd have won all these titles over these years. But maybe he'd have just got to the same point and had a bit more success in the short term, but retired, never thought about coming back and having the second career.
Or,
you know, you can never be sure of what would happen. Of course, Ferrari continued to be up and down in this period as well. But that, I think the thing is that he is associated with one of those golden eras of Ferrari. When we see this with Ferrari, there's few periods where it really comes together and the potential is lived up to. And that Lauda period in the mid-70s was one of them, just as the Schumacher one was for a slightly longer period of time earlier in this century.
Yeah, I'd argue it's actually only really happened twice. You know, I think when Lauda went to Ferrari, he couldn't believe. He said, how do they not win every race? And he's not the only driver to have said that. You know, now their facilities are still pretty impressive, but back then they were on a completely different level to everyone else. And how they, you know, they had their own test track and the facilities on the site, and obviously doing their own engines. And obviously later on, the integration became so important between the two, and they'd always had that. So, yeah, I mean, this is a different podcast, but the story of Ferrari is failing to live up to the promise, really, except for, as you say, when Lauda and Forghieri were together in the 70s, and then the Schumacher, Braun, Bern era in the 2000s. And we're still waiting for them to get to their third one.
But I think the one thing you can say is that for this era, obviously the 70s was very competitive for Formula One. You can argue 74 through to 79, he was unquestionably one of the best couple of drivers. I'm just trying to think who'd take over him in that period. Probably not. I mean, James Hunt on his day could be, but you take Lauda over Hunt, I think, in terms of the all-round package, quite happily. And there's guys like Scheckter there who are very good, but maybe not quite, again, the all-round package that Lauda was. And then Gilles Villeneuve just starting to come onto the scene as well. But yeah, if you he kind of connects up, fills that gap between Stewart and, I guess, Piquet.
Yeah, I think he is the driver of his era, really, isn't he? If we're honest, yeah, I think he is, but perhaps not by as much a margin as some of the other guys we've talked about. So that's why I was thinking, 10th, 11th. Yeah, but absolutely, yeah, one of the benchmark drivers, and certainly the best all-round package of that. You know, I think on that grid there would have been quicker drivers. I think, as you say, Hunt probably was faster over a lap. Ronnie Peterson could be. Villeneuve, as you say, was just coming in. But I don't think there was as complete a driver after Stewart and before Prost, really, as Lauda.
Yeah, I think that's always a good test, isn't it? Is there a period where he'd be the first guy, if you had any choice of drivers, I think Lauda would be the one you'd take. And I think the thing that is positive is just how simple he would have been to deal with. I think that characterised him throughout, that he was straightforward and to the point. And while not a politician, he was able to deal with people at a corporate level reasonably well, provided they were direct. And it's quite useful to be able to almost divide his career up. So you have these sort of three phases. The first half of the career has the two halves, before and post-accident. And, of course, you have the comeback later on. Which there's kind of mixed messages about exactly why he came back, really, because obviously the Lauda Air, which is a commercial airline that he was investing his time in, wasn't in the world's greatest shape, but he regularly denied that was the motivator. Even later on, he said he could have got out of it whenever he wanted, so it wasn't actually a major crisis, but he presumably wanted to did that genuinely want to come back. I imagine there was a bit of both.
I like to believe the Lauda version. That's sort of more romantic, isn't it? They just would have wanted to. I mean, Ron Dennis, apparently, McLaren boss, was ringing him pretty much every other month. Are you going to come back? You're going to come back.
And well, this was that period. If you remember, if you look back in old autosports from that period in the early 80s, there's loads of this going on. There's a bit of a driver shortage. And you even see stories about people trying to tempt Hunt back or Jackie Stewart with big money offers because they're just looking for drivers. So you can see why that would have happened.
Mm. And he said to start with that watching a Grand Prix after he retired, he had absolutely no interest at all. And then I think it must have been some point in 81 he went to a Grand Prix. I think it was probably the Austrian Grand Prix, and watched it and actually quite enjoyed it and thought, ooh. And because Ron had been honoured him, he eventually agreed to do a test at Donington Park. To see if he still could. And he was horrendously out of shape, and the new ground effect cars he didn't really enjoy. So he had to do what I'd describe as the Derek Warwick trick of coming up with an excuse to come in every few laps because his neck was gone, but to ask for a setup change was quite a good little tactic. And then went away and decided, I think he got within a tenth of Wattie, John Watson, who'd set the benchmark time, decided that was pretty handy, went away, got fit, and was ready to go for the start of the 82 season.
And very quickly, he was a winner again at Long Beach in that season. So yeah, it was in that regard like he'd never been away. I guess the thing is that sometimes drivers do benefit from a break. We recently had Kimi Raikkonen, who marked his 300th Grand Prix entered at Monaco, not his 300th start, because there were a few non-starts in that period, so not officially his 300th start. But he said that if he hadn't had those 2 years off when he did rallying, there's no way he'd still be racing in Formula One now, because he had that break, that time away. And I think that maybe that had an effect for Lauda. He had a few years off, kind of just the relentless grind of just being a Grand Prix driver will have been taken away, and then suddenly you're kind of refreshed. You've had a go at a different challenge. You're refreshed, ready to come back and give it another go.
Well, also he said he got frustrated with the pace of life outside of motor racing. He said everyone in F1 is geared for lap time and do it as quick as possible. New changes, here's a problem, solution, go, and onward and onward. And he found that the normal life, business life, he found that he had to really make a mental effort to slow himself down. And I think that probably was a bit frustrating as well. So, yeah, I like to believe that it was more that he came back for personal reasons rather than financial, although he did do an incredible... I think he was the best paid Formula One driver ever when he came back. I can't remember whether it was for 82 or whether he did a new deal for 83 and 84 where he got paid a lot. But, I mean, he did make sure that Ron Dennis and Marlborough did pay for his services.
Yeah, and they got good value out of it. Obviously, he was instrumental in terms of kind of driving on the team and getting that TAG Porsche engine into the car slightly earlier than they planned, which was useful, gave them a rolling start into 84, which obviously benefited them.
Well, I think that's another classic Lauda move, wasn't it? John Barnard, the designer, who he rated highly, but was absolutely convinced that they didn't need to run the Porsche engine car at the end of 83. We'd come out of the blocks in 84, and Nicky, turbo technology then was, okay, so it had been established in Formula One, it had taken over by then, but getting a project up and running was pretty hard going. Renault had it the longest and never won a championship with it, so he was adamant that it needed to be in. He went behind Barnard and Ron Dennis's back to Marlborough to put pressure on them to run the car. And for the last four races of 83, he had the MP41E. And in three of those races, he had problems, I think. Three meetings, he had problems. And then the fourth one, bang, suddenly they were there and they were the quickest thing apart from a Brabham BMW. So what would have happened in 84 had that not happened? Would they have wasted the first three or four rounds with silly little problems? So again, Lauda probably deserves some of the credit for their incredible 84 season from behind the scenes point of view, not just the driving.
No, very much so. And I think any team benefits from having a driver who they can really focus on and really knows that. Prost was probably starting to be able to be that, but maybe not quite there at that stage as he would be, because he was still inexperienced. Obviously, he'd come from the Renault environment, which was a good team, but maybe perhaps not the most focused at times.
Well, of course, the groundwork had already been done for 84 because Prost was a late signing. Because obviously Renault used him as the scapegoat about that, because obviously he'd done all the work and this young hot shoe was coming in.
Yeah, John Watson made the mistake of not signing a deal when he had the chance.
He overestimated his own market value. but he did, I mean, he did. I mean, Prost coming in was a different proposition. Although they did have very similar approaches. He found him very easy to work with. I think he was suspicious of him to start with. But they were very honest with each other. Their setups tended to work. It was a dream team. Yes, if we're talking about two of the top 10 or 12 drivers in F1 history together and working together successfully, which is not what happened later on in the decade.
And of course, the famous 84 season with Lauda winning the title by half a point against Prost, often characterised as the wily veteran against the younger, rawer driver. There's a small element of that, but I think also, ultimately, Lauda did have some luck on his side that year. We've got to accept that.
Yeah, he definitely... Well, if you look at how far off in qualifying he was, we've talked about why that was already, he did obviously get close in the races. But by and large, even though he was in the ballpark, Prost was still going to beat him at most races. There were very few events in 84 where Lauda beat Prost in a straight fight in the races. So he did need luck on his side to win, even up to the finale, you know, which we'll come to later. You know, he required Nigel Mansell's Lotus to retire to get into the second place he needed to win the championship. So I do think that he was fortunate to win that title. But then looking at it overall, over his career, you'd say, as we said, he should probably have had at least one more in the 70s. So it kind of balances out in the end.
Oh, yeah. I think certainly a triple world champion, he definitely is right to be one. Obviously, 85, he did tail off a bit. He did actually have quite a lot of bad luck as well in that season. Almost the slight luck that went from 84 went against him in 85. So I think his final season was maybe better than it was made out, than it looks on paper. It looks like he's like won the last championship and then just sort of sat back and only really bothered on one weekend. That's not quite fair.
It wasn't a Jody Scheckter 1980 type season where he basically couldn't be bothered from the start. And of course, in fairness to Scheckter, obviously the 85 McLaren was much more competitive than the 80 Ferrari. But no, he was still competitive, but he had, yeah, as you say, he had absolutely woeful luck. And also he's talked about not being the loved person by Ron Dennis. And this has actually come up a few times during McLaren's history. I think Nicky never suggested he didn't get equal equipment. He said that McLaren absolutely professional, equal equipment, but it was clear where Ron's feelings were, it was with Prost, as they later were with Senna, as they later were with Hakkinen over DC. You know, Ron had his favourites, and Nicky didn't feel that it, and in fact, he confronted him on one day about it, and it was basically, well, because you got so much money out of me in that negotiation sort of thing, which is pretty interesting insight into the way Ron Dennis thinks as well.
Was it in the Nigel Robert piece where he said when Lauda announced his retirement at the end of the season, for the end of the season, I think, was it in Austria, the Austrian Grand Prix?
Austrian Grand Prix, 85, retirement. Yeah.
Yeah, Ron Dennis then talked about, well, next year we'll have two top drivers again, and I think this wasn't the Robot piece, was it?
It was, yeah, in this week's magazine.
And
yeah,
it was a sort of a slightly classless thing to do, which Lauda wasn't especially delighted with, given that that's kind of...
Well,
because the standard thing is to say very nice things about the person who's won you the previous year's championship. It wasn't like 85 was going badly for the team, was it?
Yeah, no, I think Nigel Roebuck describes that as the he'd never before or since seen Nicky so angry. Now, Nigel Roebuck knew Lauda for over 40 years. And I imagine that Nicky was cross on a few occasions during that time. So that, yeah, gives you some idea. I think Ron did later apologise for that, to be fair. I think he just got the mood of the moment wrong and upset Lauda, which is unfortunate.
Well, before we get on to his greatest races, we should just talk about the post-F1 Nicky Lauda. We don't want to get into it too much. This isn't kind of what we're really trying to talk about here, but we should say the involvement he had with Ferrari as advisor for a long time, and then team principal at Jaguar, during which he actually made a brief comeback test to show how easy it was. And to his credit, he did get out of the car after struggling and say, actually, perhaps it's not quite as easy as I'd suggested. But that's amazing, isn't it, that you had Lauda that was... early January 2002, tested the Jaguar. And then, of course, his integral part in building up the Mercedes team of today. He played a key role in terms of the negotiations between Bernie Eccleston and the Mercedes board and everything, to actually how things were going to work. So, again, those old connections still doing him good. And because he had this slightly strange non-executive chairman role, it's quite difficult from afar to really see what you got into. But he was heavily involved in quite a lot of elements of that team. And in fact, even Toto Wolff, who's kind of since Lauda had the lung transplant in the summer break last year, which knocked him out of action, you know, Wolff had to take on quite a lot of extra work. So Lauda was doing and contributing a lot to that team.
Well, must have been quite a good role for him, because in that he was kind of, whenever he was interviewed, he was separate enough that when he said something outrageous or to the point, rather than the politically correct answer, as Nigel Robarts pointed out, he was Niki Lauda being quoted. But of course, he was still playing the very important role at Mercedes. And I do wonder as well whether, because of his own honesty and to his own career, that tallies quite nicely with the way that Ross Brawn like to go about running a team. It's like there's no blame culture. We just need to find the problem and solve it. And those two things to me are very, very close. And they're the two figures quite key in the early days of that Mercedes team.
And actually, that is absolutely integral to the success that team's had, because they're very, very, very good at just creating an environment where people can stick their hand up and say, right, that was the error, let's solve it, without the fear factor, which is perhaps something that Ferrari at times hasn't always thrived in. But I think that's so important, that there's that willingness to be direct about stuff, in that somebody can be kind of held responsible without necessarily being scapegoated or cast into the ocean and banished for their error.
Yes, yeah, and the results speak for themselves, don't they? A very long period of success. But also, of course, his contribution to getting Lewis Hamilton to the team. As much as it's fortunate for Lewis that he's been at Mercedes with this incredible car, Mercedes have also been incredibly fortunate to have Lewis in the car at times, you know, especially over the last two or three years. I think there have been times where having Hamilton has made the difference between them actually losing to Ferrari or not. And Niki was, I mean, you'll know this better, I'm sure, Eddie, you've spoken to both parties, but I believe that Lauda was very key in persuading Hamilton. It was because at the point in 2012 when that conversation took place, yes, McLaren's a bit unreliable, but it was still a championship contending team, which the Mercedes wasn't quite yet.
Yeah, Mercedes had broken through as a race winner in 2012, but still had some way to go. And Lauda didn't initiate the conversations between Mercedes and Hamilton, but he was critical in getting it over the line to get Hamilton to sign on the dotted line. It was a Singapore weekend, a long conversation Hamilton and Lauda had. That, combined with the fact that Hamilton was leading the race and had a gearbox failure as a result of a bit of the mould being left in the gearbox that got loose and caused the failure. And that kind of gave him that final push to make the move across. And in fact, Lewis Hamilton, obviously the Monaco Grand Prix weekend, I was in Monaco, there were just wall-to-wall tributes to Lauda, and they were honest and heartfelt. And it just showed how much impact he'd had on everyone. Those who knew him were glowing, and kind of beyond the automatic call of duty of course you've got to pay tribute, but even those who didn't know him so well, the drivers who only occasionally dealt with him, had positive things to say. But Hamilton, as part of that, said that he'd only be a one-time world champion without Niki Lauda. Such was the influence he had in making the move to Mercedes, and I suspect Hamilton would have found himself into a championship winning car even if he'd stayed at McLaren in the short term after that. But again, it just shows the kind of impact he was able to have on drivers.
Well, I think people trusted what he said. You know, I think he was, they could believe it. So, yeah, I can well imagine that Niki was able to be very, very persuasive and convincing to Lewis, particularly after he just had another McLaren car failure during that campaign.
Yeah, you could certainly rely on Lauda, like if you did an interview with him or spoke to him, to get an honest answer. You were never suspicious about his agenda, shall we say. It was always what he thought. And yeah, just amazing that he had this second career. Well, it was almost third career. So he had the Formula One team leadership roles. Obviously, he had three airline companies. We should briefly mention the role he had when the Lauda Air flight went down. And the battle he had with Boeing to accept responsibility. It was the thrust reverser that had deployed without being commanded. And he flew simulator flights. Of course, he was a commercially rated pilot himself, Lauda, to show it wasn't recoverable. And even offered to say, well, if you think it's recoverable, send me up in a plane, we'll simulate it. We'll not simulate it, we'll make it happen, and I'll try and recover it. And
yeah, you come up with me, yeah.
Yeah, no, the thing is, obviously he knew they wouldn't allow him to do that, but I'm sure if they'd said, yeah, go on then, he'd probably have had a go just to show, and he got Boeing to admit their error. So just took that relentless, dogged determination into everything he did.
Yeah, I sort of love that. I mean, obviously not the reason for having to have that investigation in the first place. I think Nicky described it as his, you know, sort of the worst thing that ever happened in his life. But yeah, the determination, and they're just making sure they got the right result, because it wasn't, you know, wasn't going to be fudged. And I think that the day after that they made that offer, I think I'm getting this right, was when Boeing issued the statement, because I think up to that point they were still trying to, you know, put a slightly different spin on things. And when their technicians refused to go up with him, yeah, never play. I don't think you would ever want to play chicken with Nicky Lauda. He's going to beat you every time, isn't he? Surely.
That's very, very good advice. Well, yeah, the after F1 racing career of Nicky Lauda is a whole other podcast in itself. Well, let's look at his greatest races. Obviously, these are based upon you picking out just his greatest Formula One race drives. Based on circumstances, not necessarily the best results. So you started off with one of the important races in his career. We've mentioned it before, the 73 Monaco Grand Prix in the BRM. Qualified sixth, finished third before retiring with a gearbox problem, and yeah, certainly got him noticed.
Yeah, so this is, I actually did it slightly different order because I was pressed for time. I did it slightly different order. So I actually went through a load of the race reports first and then went through his autobiography. Normally I'll do it the other way around, but I was waiting for it to arrive in the post. And
it is very good to Helen back, I'd recommend.
It is. It's definitely one of the best autobiographies. I don't know who did the captions. Some of those need a little bit of a sub, I think. But the actual text itself was very good. And this one was on the bubble, and then he talks about it. And I just thought the circumstances in which it happened were remarkable, because he'd, you know, by then he was just, you know, up to his eyes in debt, and he cleverly sort of managed to move money around to get BRM's first instalment already paid them for the first few races, and the next one was due after Monaco. And again, very rational thing. I need to prove I'm a star before that payment comes along. And Monaco, I think, was the last race before the second one was due. And he put it sixth on the grid ahead of his teammate, or team leader, as supposedly Clay Regazzoni. And then a little bit fortunate to rise to third. But the only two people ahead of him were Jackie Stewart and Emerson Fittipaldi, who were obviously in the process of fighting for the world title. He was next, and he was holding off Jackie's Ferrari until the BRM broke. So Louis Stanley, BRM team boss, said, yep, you can, you know, we'll pay you now to be an actual Formula One driver. And he always credited that as being a key driver in getting the Ferrari offer for 74. So, yeah, I think it's an important early race in his career. Without that event, we may not be talking about any of the other races.
Yeah, it's a proper, I guess, kind of cometh the hour moment, isn't it? Although he had scored points, finished fifth in Belgium, hadn't he? But yeah, that was a slightly different kind of drive from a little bit lower down the grid. But Monaco, yeah, just showed he could cut it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that Belgium, actually, if I remember correctly, is there were some issues with the track and lots of people fell off. So that was a young driver keeps his head to keep the car on the road while others fall off. Whereas I think that Monaco is a great place to make a statement as a driver, isn't it? If you can hack it there. And actually, there were a lot of Monaco Grand Prix that were potentially included in this list. He really was, and we'll get to a couple more of them later on, but he really was pretty special around there. And I think that was probably the first sign of it.
Well, number nine, 1977 South African Grand Prix at Kyalami, which he won for Ferrari. Obviously a race that's remembered for different reasons, usually.
Yes, I mean, it's sort of doing this list underlined how dangerous this era of Formula One was, really. So this is the race that Tom Price was killed because of the marshal running across the road. So I think events thereafter kind of tend to get forgotten, really. But Lauda at that point hadn't won since his accident. So it was quite a key race for him. He really wanted to show that he could still do it. He tracked James Hunt's McLaren early on, went past and then disappeared down the road. Made it look very easy, but then the great drivers then are also able to do that when they've got a car problem. And actually, his car was damaged by some of the debris from that horrible accident, and he was losing water and all the gauges were off the clock and all that sort of thing. So he had to bring the car home. Rather than, yeah, it wasn't an easy cruise to the flag, basically, but another crucial win on his, I guess, a milestone on his comeback.
Yeah, very much set him on the way to the 77 title. Well, number eight is a race I'm very fond of, simply because of the circumstances in which Nicky Lauda took the lead from a driver who wasn't quite as successful, but it was quick on his day. But the 1982 US Grand Prix at Long Beach, the first win of his second F1 career.
Yeah, so this was a biding your time, on top of the job type drive, which is was pretty impressive going into his third race back. But yeah, you're referring to Andrea De Cesaris, who was that was one of his days where he'd taken a bit of a surprise pole the day before. Lauda followed him, and De Cesaris then got a bit cross in traffic. Perhaps you'd like to tell that bit of the story.
Well, he just realised that if you're using your arm raised to demonstrate that you're annoyed with Albazel holding you up, and you need to change gear with that hand, you're going to slow down. Well, not you're going to hit a bit of a wall in terms of acceleration. So yeah, he's got his arm out of the cockpit, hits the top of the gear, and Lauda just goes past him, which I just think is brilliant.
Well, I rather like Lauda's fairly sardonic account of that one, where I pulled out past him, giving him a wide berth. After all, you have to watch yourself when you pass someone who is so busy shaking his fist that he forgets he has to change gear.
Which is exactly what it was. The footage of it, there's some elevated footage that shows it from sort of side on. You can see it's like there's just a sudden point where De Cesaris runs out of acceleration.
Well, two contrasting drivers you probably couldn't think of, could you?
Yeah,
two.
Very, very, very much so. Although I do fascinating career to Andrea De Cesaris.
Yeah, that's a different. We should do that podcast. But there's a brilliant. I wasn't able to include it in the magazine piece, unfortunately. But in Nigel Robot's report of that race, he has a brilliant finish because. Alan Jones, who's obviously only just retired and has released a book, during the course of that book, which I've also read, he talks about, well, maybe the reason Lauda was so successful is because he had 12-cylinder engines during his career and he was able to crank the wing up, so he was quick through the corners and just the quickest down the straights, you know, and then he left when the DFV came into Brabham. And Robock's finished the report is just, Alan, I have news, because obviously the McLaren's DFV engine, he just defeated everyone comfortably on his third race back.
Yeah, exactly. That's that answered that question. The 1983 South African Grand Prix at Kyalami, which is not one that leaps to mind as an obvious Lauda one, but very, very good reason for that.
Yeah, well, two reasons, actually. One was because of that story that we've already talked about of him persuading... well, Marlborough, actually, to get the Porsche tag engine into the McLaren before the end of the 83 season. And this was the final race, so this is the Piquet-Prost showdown. Not that it was, really, because Prost was fighting without any weaponry by then. And he started 12th. So this is a kind of a prelude to what's going to happen the following season, really. Lauda back in the pack, and he just picks people off, he just comes through... and again, Nigel Robart described it as Nicky driving with an aggression we have not seen for a long time, but doing it with perfect line and judgment. And he was just clinically picking them all off. And he passed everyone except Piquet and Patrese in the Brabham BMWs. And obviously, when Prost retired and Piquet then kind of just cruised around to win the championship, Lauda went after Patrese. Got within 3 seconds, actually, but I think the Brabham was too quick and he was going to hold on. So it would have been a second place, a charge from second from 12th. But the car broke, so I think he was classified 11th. So yeah, in the history books, in the stats, it doesn't show up this race, but I think this is a signpost to what's going to come for the next year.
The 1984 French Grand Prix at Dijon, so that was in the McLaren in his third championship year. Certainly a race that Lauda enjoyed his own driving.
Yes, this is why I got this in. This is probably the one race that I hadn't had on my radar until I read his autobiography. But this is the race that he feels that he would have beaten Prost, irrespective of Prost's problems. Again, another charge through the field. And I think he just caught Prost when Prost peeled off into the pits with a wheel problem. And then he's left to take on Patrick Tombay's Renault. Eventually forces him into a mistake and gets the lead. The other reason it's in there is because there was a bit of confusion with the team, because Lauda had agreed with Ron Dennis to do a pit stop halfway. Ron, because of Lauda's charge, decided, oh, he doesn't need one. But Nicky was thinking, well, because I've done this charge, my tyres are stuffed, I need to change them. Got no board and only realised that the race was more than half gone when he saw, I think, someone else's sign saying how many laps to go. So he came into the pitch, the stop wasn't great, and he lost the lead again. He charged through, catches Tombay, wins the race, and he basically said that, you know, he was upset because he had to drive faster than he felt was necessary. So he pulled out the stops, basically. So he was furious for having to drive one of his best races.
Yeah, but just shows that even though in 84 Prost was the kind of the maybe the quicker driver there. Lauda's still capable of these kind of attacking drives, which is which is very good. Number five is 75 Monaco Grand Prix. So you mentioned Monaco is an important circuit for him. That one of his victories there.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is showing to that, you know, you can take taking the heat under pressure, really. Wet start, so Monaco in the wet, a challenge for anyway. And he had, he was the first attacked by Jean-Pierre Jarier, but Jarier crashed on the first lap, so I don't think he had to put up with that for too long. But he did have Ronnie Peterson and Tom Price challenging him in the wet. Made no mistakes, kept the lead, came into the stops at the right time, put on slicks, got himself a nice cushion, and then he had Fittipaldi charging at him, and still no mistakes, and kept a nice cushion, and actually did again have a car problem that he was carrying towards the end. So it had everything thrown at him, really. He had charging rivals from behind, difficult conditions, changing conditions, and a car problem, and still racked up one of his one of his 75 victories. Actually, that started him off on a run that effectively clinched the championship.
Yeah, and one of two Monaco Grand Prix victories, of course. I think he had pole there three times as well, so very strong around that circuit. In fact, it's another Monaco drive that you put fourth in this list, but not his 76th victory.
No, his 76th victory did almost make the list, but it almost seemed a bit too easy, if you like. I'm sure it wasn't, because it's Monaco, but yeah, I think in 76 he just had such a big advantage over everyone. I don't think he had to dig particularly deep at all. It was a guy at the top of his game in the best car delivering a win. Whereas 78 Monaco I got more and more excited about this the more I looked into this race. And there's footage on YouTube as well. It's worth having a look. And so he has actually outqualified by John Watson and ran, who's his teammate, and ran behind him and Patrick Depay early on, which made me think, oh, qualifying behind your teammate, is this going to make the list? And then he gets a puncture after Watson breaks a Friday and he goes down the escape road. Lauda gets a puncture, comes in, and then puts on what I would describe as a Nigel Mansell-esque charge through the pack, and ends up overtaking Scheckter's Wolf in the last three laps to get second back. So he gets back to second, and his fastest lap is not only quicker than his own practice time, his own qualifying time, it's 1.9 seconds faster than the best racing lap of anyone else in the event, which I think is the race that shows that he was quick. It wasn't just about being clever and canny and, you know, all that precision we talk about. When he had to hang it out, he would. And there's some great shots of him being sideways and going up against the barriers. He obviously just had the bit between his teeth that day, and he just absolutely went for it.
Well, Monaco, of course, is a great test of drivers' pace and their ability to really lay it on the line without overstepping the mark, and that tells you a lot about Lauda. Well, the next race, a very different drive, the 84 Portuguese Grand Prix. That's number three in your list. Of course, he finished second from down the grid to clinch the title by half a point from Prost. I think this race, more than any in 84, means people do take that view that he sort of calculated his way to the championship over the faster but less calculating Prost. Perhaps not quite that simple, though.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I initially didn't want to have this race up this high. But first of all, he picked it as his own race of my life when we... actually, I think it was Adam Cooper interviewed him perhaps in the late 80s, early 90s. And that this was the race that he picked out. And he devotes, I think, a whole chapter in his book to this race as well. It's clearly I think the battle against Prost, he considers him to be by far the hardest teammate that he had. That's very much, he doesn't actually explicitly say that. And as I say, he's very complimentary about Piquet, who he was briefly teammate with as well. But I think that going up against Prost in 84 took more out of Lauda than any of his other campaigns, and even rated it ahead of the 77 title, which, if you think about what he'd come through before, is quite amazing. But yes, he also picked this race out, I think, because he had really quite a troubled weekend. He had all sorts of problems, and even in the race, there was a problem with the left bank of the left-hand turbo on the engine. So he struggled to get through the other cars, but he was able to, he stayed patient. He didn't get himself into trouble, and he actually always thought that he would have caught Nigel Mansell's Lotus for second. And I was looking at the lap time graph on this, and it was going to be tight, because he started closing at a rate that would have done it, and they get into traffic, and Mansell's actually a bit quicker through the traffic than Lauda is, and it goes up. And if you applied the same rate of the way he was catching him before that, afterwards, it would have been very close. But of course, would they have got to the end without more traffic? I think that possibly he wouldn't quite have made it. It would have been really close.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it could have added that extra dimension of that late charge needed to do it. Could he have dug deep and put it on the line to make the move?
Yeah, if you don't,
we could never answer it.
If he caught and passed Mansell with two laps to go to win a world championship by half a point, I mean, that's even more amazing, isn't it? but yeah, I thought that just the pressure around the whole season and that race, and by then he very much felt that the team, or certainly Ron Dennis, wanted Prost to be world champion. So yeah, I think he felt he was fighting against the odds for that one.
And I think it takes a lot when you're in a fight like that and in a difficult situation to just keep your focus on doing what you're doing and not just give up almost. It's not like you think, oh, I won't bother, but you do see drivers who have adverse situations and they just don't, they just can't recover from it. They can't pick themselves up and just do what they can do. They lose track of it. And that's obviously one of the key reasons why Lauda was so successful. Well, number two on the list is last victory, 1985 Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort, the high point of his final season.
Yes, yeah, so it's another one of these battles against Prost, and they both make pit stops. Lauda comes through the field but can't get to Prost, he says, because he picked, in those days you could pick different compounds and different corners of the car, which I think they should bring back. I think that was great. And he had three softs and one hard, and he had too much oversteer. And he claimed that the agreement was if he stopped after a certain point, they would bolt four softs on. And they came in and he had the tyre stop and he went out. He still doesn't handle right. And they put three softs and one hard on again. Prost came in later and had a worse stop. So Lauda actually takes the lead. Prost comes out, but he is on the four softs. And, you know, Prost at this point is heading for his first world title. Lauda's had a dismal season. And the expectation is that Prost will obviously catch and pass him. There are no team orders. And I don't think, you know, Lauda was happy to help Prost to win that title, but not at that point in the season. Prost closed him down and Lauda held him off, including a real, I'm not going to say Verstappen-style attack, but a pretty major lunge from Prost on the last lap into the chicane that Nicky defends well and holds on, despite the fact that obviously the tyres are pretty gone and the car's unbalanced by then and wins by 0.2 seconds. So possibly the hardest challenge he had for a race lead at the end during his career. And to hold off, I think it's kind of almost a changing of the guard, but not just quite yet. It's his last great win, I think.
Well, of course, it was almost his final act in Formula One because he had an accident with a throttle stuck open, missed a couple of races. John Watson actually replaced him at Brands Hatch that year. So I think it's great that he did have that final victory in the last season. It showed that he could very much still do it. And well, number one, another one that's not a victory, but it's funny, we kind of talk about a driver who almost, the evaluation of him always gets overwhelmed by the Nürburgring accident. And then, of course, you've gone with the Italian Grand Prix at Monza where he finished fourth.
I've gone ruined
coming back.
Ruined the whole structure of your podcast, Ed. Yeah, sorry. I just thought...
You can't get past it, though, can you?
I just think it's beyond the normal way you can judge a race. I think to come back from an accident like that with the injuries that he had, the circumstances of Ferrari that we talked about, the pilling the balaclava off. And also, he was frightened of the car on the Friday when he came back. So it's 6 weeks after his Nürburgring crash. His injuries are still, I think, raw is probably the best way of putting it. He's not mentally right to go racing, to be honest. I think Jackie Stewart later said that he shouldn't probably have been there. And he probably wouldn't have been allowed to do it now. But to come out, scare himself on the Friday, completely reset, come out and then out qualify the other two Ferraris, because there were three Ferraris for that race. Reutemann and Regazzoni were in the cars as well. And then to drive at racing speeds, with a helmet, I think, on a bit more loosely, because obviously all these facial injuries, and to hold off, it wasn't a cruise round either. He had Jody Scheckter right on his backside at the end. I think he'd beaten by a tenth to take fourth. Just, I think, a race so far above what we would normally measure this criteria. I think it's probably the greatest motorsport comeback. And I just thought, I can't not put it first. So sorry if I've ruined your plans.
No, you can't argue with it, really. It's a unique set of circumstances, isn't it? And I think it reflects, again, that just determination that he wanted to come back and show he could still. It's almost like that refusal to be beaten by the accident And that's why he wanted to get in as soon as he possibly could, even if it was not necessarily a very wise idea. And of course, also that result laid the foundations for him almost winning the World Championship.
Well, of course, had Fuji been dry, you would probably say that that Monza performance is a World Championship winning race. Because he actually excluded McLaren and they were having a disastrous weekend, Italian authorities, blah, blah. So those 3 points could have won in the championship. In fact, he talks about Fuji later on in his autobiography where he basically said, it stopped raining shortly after the start. He said, all I had to do was cruise round. There were enough people falling off and not going very quickly. I could probably have speeded up later on when it dried. But, you know, I think he was braver for pulling in, really, and sticking to his guns on that. But, I mean, I made a... Because, as you know, I love lists, so I did start making lists of greatest motorsport comebacks, and I ended up with Lauda at number 1 and 2. Second for 82 and 1 for Monza 76.
Yeah, well, that's a good way of looking at it. And I think, to summarise, Niki Lauda, just someone who just had an incredible impact on Formula 1, not just through his success as a driver, but off track, and just a character who achieved so much in such a correct way, I guess, the way he went about things as well. It just makes him just a completely, entirely different kind of world champion to all the other greats, really. You can't really put him in a box with another great driver. He sort of stands there as someone who did it his way and did it brilliantly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's quite a good summary, isn't it? He did do it his way, and no apologies for it. But not in a way that I don't think he did anything wrong, as you say. It wasn't like he had a reputation for just driving people off the road or for...
There were a few clashes early on.
Yeah, but he didn't...
That's the same for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have the debate about him like you would have, say, about Senna or Schumacher in terms of their on-track etiquette and stuff like that. And he doesn't have the Fernando Alonso sort of... Is he not destructive within the team? You know, he was forthright, but, you know, the teams he was at were better when he was there. You know, he was a person who could pull a team around him and get it to go in the right way. And that was whether he was in the cockpit or not. Just a very successful person with whatever he turned his mind to, I think.
Yeah, and a great loss to the Formula One paddock. The reaction in Monaco, as I said, was heartfelt. And I think when you get someone who has that impact on so many people, you have to sort of take seriously their contribution. I mean, I can't say I knew him massively well, but I did deal with him obviously in Formula One over the years, and always found him an interesting and engaging and forthright character. So I don't think I'm in the minority on that one. So yeah, a great driver, and it's always a shame when you get to this point that these people that are part of the furniture almost, you always take for granted, suddenly they're not here, and you can't go and ask him any more questions about this race or that race and say, do you agree with this ranking we've come up
with?
Well,
yeah, it's a shame he's not here now to go over, you know, to just do a podcast with him and talk about all the stuff that we have done, but with him. But there you go.
I'm sure he'd had some forthright opinions.
I'm sure he'd have told me what was wrong with my list.
Plenty, I imagine. But yeah, a great loss to motorsport, but what an incredible life, you know, that did so much in so many different arenas that if he'd just done one set of those things, you'd be talking about what a legend he was. So a great loss, and it's been great to talk about him and his efforts behind the wheel. So thanks very much, Kevin Turner. Obviously, this week's Autosport has got your greatest Niki Lauda drives and that Nigel Roebuck piece we mentioned a few times. So pick up Autosport magazine for a copy of that. That should be out now. Do check out autosport.com. There's still some Niki Lauda content you can find on there. We ran a whole load of stuff when the unfortunate news emerged. And of course, we've got all the news from Formula One and the rest of the world of motorsport. And do have a look at our Plus subscriber area, where for a small fee, you can read the world's best motorsport journalists on all sorts of topics. Check out Sister Titles, F1 Racing Magazine, out monthly, motorsport.com and Motorsport News. And obviously the Autosport podcast is out every Monday and Thursday, so subscribe to us on iTunes, go to the Spreaker website, you can like us on there if you like what you hear. We regularly do these great driver podcasts. They crop up every few months or so. We've done Graham Hill in the past, Ronnie Peterson. They're always interesting.
Yeah, who should we do next? Perhaps the readers and listeners should tell us who they'd like us to do. Actually, no, then I'd have to do another list really quickly, wouldn't I? I'll work on them all.
I think we should do Andrea De Cesaris, seeing as he crops up in this one.
I might struggle with the 10. We could do the 10 most hilarious retirements.
But I think if he had a third of Niki Lauda's self-control, I think he'd have probably won quite a few races. So thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast. Music is 6am by Trelo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trelo Music.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
The just because deal.
Hey, oh, what's this?
Breakfast from Mickey D's.
From me?
Yep.
Why?
Because it's morning and you like McDonald's. Let's eat while it's hot.
There's a deal for every act of kindness at McDonald's.
You don't need a reason when the one and only hot and melty sausage McMuffin with egg is just $2.50. Price and participation may vary, cannot be combined with any other offer.
Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.